One of the leading writers at New Yorker magazine is with me tonight. He's been here before, Adam Gopnik, who used to hang around Paris a lot and did some wonderful writing about that for the magazine and in some books that followed. He's done various other things, and now a most unusual and truly an interesting and engrossing book titled Angels and Ages, subtitle, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. Of course, what makes Darwin and Lincoln combinable in a book, particularly this year, is that tomorrow we celebrate the 200th anniversary of the birth of each of them.
They were born
within just a few hours of one another. Is that right?
Seem to have been. They're born on the same day on opposite sides of the Atlantic Ocean, but 200 years ago, sun in a couple of hours from now. It's, you know, it's in one sense, it's just a coincidence, but it's a pretty cosmic coincidence that these two guys were born on the same day. And in the book, as you know, I don't want to try and make some kind of Plutarchian argument for absolute parallels between their lives. I don't think that's what matters or that's what interests me. It's that because they live these parallel lives, Lincoln's of course ends much sooner, that we are able to sort of look back at them and sort of walk around them, walk around the plinth of these two monumental figures and think about what their lifetimes offered and how their lives and words changed our thoughts about ourselves. To ask sort of what's the legacy of Lincoln and Darwin in 2009?
Of course, the general point you make is that they both speeded us towards modernity, which was coming on anyway, but
yes,
the shape that modernity took was strongly influenced by both of them, you say.
Exactly so. Now, the shape that modernity took was not caused by them and was not their invention, but as I say, they midwifed our modernity, particularly our moral modernity, the way we see the world and how we organize our experience and its meanings. They midwifed it. Lincoln is the towering figure of not so much the birth of democracy, of liberal democracy, but of its defense. Remember, the crucial thing is when he's born in 1809, the standard rap on democracy around Europe and around the world is it's doomed. It always is. Think of the French Revolution. It always eats itself up. It devours its own. It ends, as Lincoln himself said later, in anarchy or tyranny. And even someone like de Tocqueville, when he came to America, said it's very hard for me to believe that this wonderful experiment can go on. By the end of Lincoln's life, people were persuaded that liberal democracies, open societies, could not only exist, but that they could defend themselves against an internal challenge.
As I've been reading your book with great fascination on my part, yet another connection between the two of them, or something similar in their lives and basic in the arc of their lives, occurred to me. Both of them live with death. I don't mean merely the death of a child. Each of them in his family had that tragedy, the death of one of the children. But rather, try this on for size. Darwin, of course, is focused on death in that he's interested in the emergence of new species on the basis of the extinction of old. Those that are not well fitted for altered environments die, not merely as individuals, all individuals die, but die as a species. Lincoln, of course, is far more directly associated with death in that he sent a vast, vast number of men,
hundreds of thousands,
to their death. More were killed in that war than, I have been told by some historians, than all the major wars we know of combined in human history up to the time of the Civil War.
Until that moment. That's exactly right, Mel. That is the central theme of this book. Darwin, you're absolutely right, becomes aware of what he calls, ominously and beautifully, the wedge of death as the great sorter out of the history of life. Remember, until Darwin's time, when people thought about evolution, and they did think about evolution, they thought of it as a kind of progressive, what used to be called a vitalist force. Species had a natural inclination to get better. Darwin understood that it was only the wedge of death, it was only extinction that sorted out species and made evolution happen.
And that it was all dreadfully accidental, so to speak.
Exactly.
Had no plan to it.
There was no plan to it. There was no design to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't accidental in the sense that natural selection worked. It wasn't random, but there was no plan. You couldn't predict where it was going when it started. And Lincoln, exactly as you say, became aware in the deepest, most immediate. You know, one of my favorite images of Lincoln is of Lincoln at the soldier's home in Washington, which is the summer house he went to, kind of his own Camp David. And it's a beautiful and comfortable house, but there's a military cemetery right outside it. So all day in his summer vacation, he heard and didn't resist hearing the sounds of the young men he had sent to their deaths being buried.
Only this morning, and quite by accident, I happened to turn on a television set and caught on the History Channel something about the Battle of Antietam, a one-hour replay of the Battle of Antietam, where something like 20,000 men die in one day.
Yes, and they stood there, and just, funny, I was just reading in my hotel room last night an account of the Battle of Antietam, how badly the North messed it up. They presented it as a victory, but in fact they lost it. And yes, the Civil War was the first war, you know, it was war where the defense had such an advantage on the offense because of the nature of new kinds of rifles that basically you stood there and fired at your alternate in the other army. And the scale of the carnage, the cruelty of the carnage was almost unbelievable. And no one anticipated it. No one said going in 1861, it's going to be this kind of a war. And Lincoln was very cold-blooded. You know, it wasn't that he was...
Oh, yes.
He was the man who said those horrible words, I need a general who can grasp the dreadful arithmetic. That is, as long as there's going to be attrition, as long as we're going to stand and fire, there are more of us in the North than there are of them in the South.
The trouble with McClellan, in Lincoln's view, was that he didn't want to spend too many of his soldiers' lives.
Did not grasp the dreadful arithmetic. And you're exactly right that dreadful arithmetic is at the heart of Lincoln's consciousness, and it's the heart of our modernity, that recognition that liberal societies, open societies, fight for good values, but they fight. We're the authors of the Civil War and of Hiroshima, along with the Constitution and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Doesn't that, about Lincoln, I speak of Lincoln now, not of Darwin, doesn't that give you some pause and lead you to some uncertainty over the apotheosis that we've worked upon Lincoln, the great Lincoln myth of the great emancipator and the man of pure and deep spirituality, the fact that he was able to marshal vast armies, sending hundreds of thousands of young men to their death?
Yes, of course it does. And, you know, I'm a Canadian, so it has a double edge, because in Canada, when we contemplate, tragically, the possible dissolution of the country, nobody suggests a resort to violence in order to defend Confederation. So, yes.
You know, where they shout, Vive la Québec libre.
That's right. And people don't want it, but they don't say, let's send hundreds of thousands of young Canadians to their death on its behalf. Yes, well, you know, Edmund Wilson, one of my heroes and a great predecessor, wrote a whole book,
a great book,
Patriotic Gore, as you know, where he says, basically, why are we weepy about Lincoln? Lincoln was the American Bismarck, says, comparing him to the great Prussian nationalist. He says he was a nationalist who brought the country together, but he didn't give a damn about slaves. He didn't give a damn about anything except national power. A great, formidable figure, Wilson says, but, you know, nobody for Carl Sandburg to weep over. I half agree with that, Milt, but not entirely. The more you look at Lincoln, and the part of the pleasure of writing this book for me has been just reading Lincoln as much as I could as an amateur, the more impressive he is as a man, for the reasons we were talking about before. Lincoln is not a man of cold blood. He doesn't reject his responsibility for what's happening.
And does he suffer over it?
He suffers deeply over it. You know, one of my favorite images of Lincoln is of Lincoln reciting Shakespeare at the soldiers' home. And what he recites again and again are the most blood-drenched and guilty of all the soliloquies.
That speech by Claudius, you quoted, of course, almost full length. Claudius trying to pray and not able to do so because the power that he now has, he got by killing his brother,
the former king.
That's
right, the stain of blood of fratricide is so deep in him. Yeah. I don't think that Lincoln thought he was guilty of the sin that Claudius was guilty of, but he was capable of empathizing with and understanding the close relation between violence and evil. So Lincoln emerges as a great tragic figure in that way. He's not a cold-hearted Bismarckian emperor, but nor is he a weepy-eyed conciliatory figure. He's the least conciliatory figure in all of American history. He's the man who says, we've conciliated long enough. You fire on the fort, we're at war. That's the essence of Lincoln, and Lincoln is also the man who says, this country cannot survive half slave and half free.
A great question, of course, presents itself and forces itself upon you. I pose the question just as we're about to stop for some commercials, so you can think about it for
a
few minutes. And it's one you've thought about many times before. What if Lincoln had played it differently? And I know there's a lot of pressure on him to put down the rebellion, to put never to acknowledge the legitimacy of the Confederacy. But what if he had played it differently? What if he had resisted the pressures upon him to go to war, to whip the Confederate states back into the Union, but it said, rather, let them go. let them go. Ultimately, they may come back, and if they don't, the larger portion in terms of wealth and manpower, the population of the Union is still here, and we still are a formidable nation in the world, and will continue to grow and expand west, and it will ultimately work out as Providence determines, but Providence will probably serve us well. It's historical contingency. Could he have had that choice? Was it available to him, or was he in fact propelled forward on an inevitable course? And if he had that choice and had taken the opposite choice, what would the how would our lives now be different? A number of questions all bound into a what-if proposition. As we pause just briefly, returning to Adam Gopnik in a few minutes after these words. Our guest tonight is Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker magazine, author of the new book, Angels and Ages, a short book, and this is in the subtitle. I don't know why you insist on calling it a short book. It's sort of an average-sized modern book,
It was meant ironically, Mel. I meant because it's a book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life, and it's a short book. So it was meant as a mild joke, not as a neutral description.
Yes, and of your modesty, we say nothing.
Yeah, exactly. it's my irony more than my modesty that's a play in the...
Irony about your chutzpahdik adventure.
Exactly. The chutzpah to write it and the chutzpah to say it's a short book.
I love it.
Let me try and answer your question about what if Lincoln had acted differently. There were people who said, Horace Greeley said, let the erring sisters go in peace. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem with that. Two problems. One is that there was no movement, though Lincoln himself was not an absolute abolitionist. Nonetheless, he had come to power as a man who believed that the country could not survive half slave and half free, and he thought that slavery should be on its way to extinction. He did, from our point of view, almost unfortunately, in the first inaugural, make a gesture to the South. He said he would tolerate an amendment, an unamendable amendment, which allowed slavery to continue in the Southern states so long as it didn't spread elsewhere. Seward, the Secretary of State, convinced him of that, and it looks now like a bit of a stain because it would have allowed for the extension of slavery. Nobody in the South, and there's a series of letters that Lincoln has with Stevens, one of the leading Southern politicians. Shockingly, Milt, nobody in the South was willing to say, you know what, let's have gradual emancipation. You pay us enough money, and over 25 or 30 years, we'll emancipate the slaves, which would have been, in many respects, a horrible thing, but which would probably have resolved the conflict, would probably have sold in the North. Nobody in the South wanted to do that. By that point, the ideology of slavery, the ideology of racism was so deeply implanted, and the business of slavery was so profitable, as people sometimes still deny, that that wasn't about to happen. And then more deeply, Lincoln was committed to legalism. Lincoln was committed to the rule of logic and law. And to his mind, and he makes this perfectly plain in the first inaugural and many other places, you could not back out of the Union unilaterally any more than I can back out of a contract I've made with you unilaterally. That it wasn't that there were two different principles. It was a question about slavery, and then there was a question of union. The essence of democracy was that the majority was able to rule so long as it didn't lynch the minority, and that if the minority simply took its marbles and went home every time that happened, then democracy itself was impossible. Then you would simply have an endless centrifugal spinning off of the country. And I think if there's one thing that I learned, Milton, the one thing that I wanted to emphasize in this book, it's that the Civil War is not the narrow insular territorial dispute that we still learn it as. It was a conflict of worldwide significance in the sense that every liberal in England, liberal in France recognized if the North loses, then that means that the dream of democracy is demolished.
The slogan that the protesters used at the 1968 Democratic Convention here in Chicago was, the whole world's watching.
The whole world was watching. The whole world was watching. Darwin was watching Lincoln, and everyone was watching to see, with government of the people, by the people, for the people, perish from the earth. We see that as a rhetorical gesture. If you were a liberal in England, you didn't see it as a rhetorical gesture. You saw it as a plain truth.
I'm very glad you mentioned Darwin was watching Lincoln. Was Lincoln, let's begin to talk about these two men and whether they perceived one another. Darwin, obviously, as all the world, as the Western world, would have perceived that Lincoln was there and would have known about the Civil War. Was Lincoln particularly aware of the beginnings of evolutionary theory?
He was aware of the beginnings of evolutionary theory. He and Darwin shared a book that they both read and absorbed and admired by an obscure Scots publisher named Robert Chambers. It's called The Vestiges of Natural Creation. It's a very influential book in the 1830s. And it was one of the books, actually, Mill, that turned Lincoln towards atheism, because it's a book about evolution. It has no evidence. It's not a scientific book. It's a kind of philosophical speculation.
At this point, 1830s, at this point, it should be made clear to those who are a little bit confused by it, that evolutionary theory had been around for a long, long time. The distinctive thing about Darwin is that he found the mechanism
exactly,
of evolution.
Exactly.
But
so.
It was understood by many who weren't tied to a literal endorsement of the book of Genesis, that animals transformed into other animals.
Animals over time.
And botanical forms as well.
That right. Some people were willing to accept that. And
yeah.
There's a very funny letter from Darwin to Huxley saying, you know what, I think that this book, The Vestiges of Creation, which Lincoln loved, is a bit silly because it's not really a scientific argument, but I'm even more radical about species than
mm-hmm.
he is. Anyway, Lincoln certainly knew that book, and it changed Lincoln's mind. I don't think that there's any evidence that Lincoln was aware of Darwin, because by the time Darwin finally publishes On the Origin of Species, after his legendary 20-year delay, it's 1859, and Lincoln has many other things on his mind. But let me just add, Lincoln mm-hmm. was a great proponent of the natural sciences. National Academy of Sciences was a Lincoln-era invention.
But 1859, after all, that's the Civil War hasn't yet even begun, and Lincoln reads a lot and is very much aware of the main drifts or the main currents of contemporary culture. Why would he not have heard, at least read a newspaper account?
I suspect he did, and I suspect that we just don't have trace of it. It's not as if Lincoln kept a
journal. We have
journal.
No trace at all of it.
Right, we have no trace of it. It certainly was the kind of, it was part of what was there in the time. But, you know, Lincoln is fascinating because Lincoln is a great writer, truly great writer, and a great reader. But the things that appeal to him tend to be, it's one of the reasons he's such a great writer, is because his models are so select. He loves Shakespeare. He absorbs Shakespeare into his bones, memorizes it, and my favorite image, he puts people to sleep reciting Shakespeare at them. All the young secretaries try to stay awake while he recites Shakespeare, and they can't. He loves Aesop's fables. He loves Civil War humor, Petroleum v. Nasby, and so on. But he's not a omnivorous reader in that way. He's a select reader who draws on the models that he needs in order to articulate the ideas that matter to him.
Let us come to this young fellow who is descended from potters and clergymen.
And that's right.
Charles Darwin. If Lincoln's born in a log cabin, Darwin's born on a comfortable country estate.
Yes, Darwin is born in a position of considerable wealth. His father's a very successful doctor. He comes from a very distinguished family on both sides, Darwin's and Wedgwood's. He's a huge disappointment to his father. Darwin should be there as a sign for any parent who gets fed up with an adolescent kid, because there was never a more disappointing adolescent kid than Charles Darwin. His father said to him once, "You are the great disappointment of my life, and you'll never be good for anything but shooting and rat catching."
What was so disappointing about him?
Darwin was one of those kids who only was a serial obsessive. He was fascinated by one thing at a time, and he went deep into it. He was fascinated by Beatles.
He and he collected everything.
Collected every Beatle he could find. He was like the kid under the table when you're trying to have a conversation who's doing nothing but his Beatles. He failed in school. He was no good in school because he didn't have that kind of scholarly mind. He couldn't divide his mind up amongst many subjects. And it was only when he finally got the offer to go on the voyage of the Beagle.
Yeah.
And do you know what his father said to him at that point? He said, "You realize what this means," he said, "that they're offering you this job. It means they've offered it to every other naturalist in England, and every other naturalist has turned it down." Imagine your father saying that to you.
Do you think it's
scraping the bottom of the barrel?
Did it really mean something like that?
It was alarmingly close to the truth.
Yeah.
But then Darwin goes on that boat ride. And, you know, there's a moment in everyone's life when you do something and you find yourself. And Darwin found himself on the Beagle, and he never looked back.
Well, we've just segued from Lincoln to Darwin. We'll bring them together again. But after an impending newscast, let's get on the Beagle with Darwin. Let's begin to track the development of his scientific consciousness, or the further development of it, leading, indeed, to his long hesitation in putting his notion about natural selection out before the world. As you said earlier, I think, some 20 years he hesitates before publishing The Origin of Species.
That's right.
We return to, you didn't hesitate before you published Angels and Ages.
I scarcely hesitated 6 weeks.
There you are. But it's a wonderful book. And we'll return to it and to its author, Adam Gopnik. So, as we return to Adam Gopnik, let's indeed start the voyage of the Beagle. Who commanded the Beagle? What was the Beagle up to?
Fitzroy was the commander of the Beagle. Beagle was going to circumnavigate the globe on and collect specimens for scientific specimens. And Darwin was the naturalist, an important role. he started off miserably. He was nauseated all the time. He was seasick, as you often, I suppose you always were on those kinds of boats. But it was a liberating experience for him because he found himself. He was a kind of timid kid. And there he was riding on the Pampas with the gauchos not long after. And he began, he doesn't think about evolution on that trip. That's a myth that he begins to discover it.
But the immediate form of that myth is that down in the Galapagos, he saw the variation in the beak length on
exactly
on
so.
The finches,
right.
The finch birds, and that sort of got him started on
not,
natural selection. Not,
not
true
so,
at all.
Not so. That's yeah. been disproven. What he did do on that voyage is he looked at things. One of the things that's very moving about Darwin is he just loved to look, and he was an amazingly gifted observer. And we sometimes he was also an incredible theorist and a great imaginative thinker. But at core, he loved to look at things. And even later in life, it was one of the beautiful things about Darwin, when he would publish a book like The Descent of Man.
Yeah.
He would publish the next year a book about the formation of vegetable mold by earthworms. He loved the kind of micro inspection as much as the macro.
I've got an assignment for you. Can you find quickly one of your longish excerpts of his naturalistic writing?
I have it right in front of me here because it's so wonderful.
It's great to
read. This is from The Voyage of the Beagle. It's
right.
About fireflies. At these times, the fireflies are seen flitting about from hedge to hedge. On a dark night, the light can be seen at about 200 paces distant. It is remarkable that in all the different kinds of glowworms, shining elaters, and various marine animals, which I have observed, the light has been of a well-marked green color. I found that this insect emitted the most brilliant flashes when irritated, and the flash was almost co-instantaneous in the two rings, but it was just perceptible first in the anterior one. That's the kind of insanely detailed looking that runs through the beagle, and it was inseparable from his gift for generalization, for imaginative leaps, and that's what makes The Voyage of the Beagle such a wonderful book to read. And as I tell in this book, I was so infused with The Voyage of the Beagle that we were on a family holiday in the Caribbean, and I thought, I'm going to be like the young Darwin and go out and just look at fish, and you know, it's insanely difficult.
You went scuba diving.
Went scuba diving, and just to, there's a, you know, in effect, you disturb the fish, they disturb you. That kind of organized, ordered, high definition looking is part of Darwin's gift, and it's wonderful to see him discovering that it actually has a role in the world on The Voyage of the Beagle.
The beagle is out there for what, 6 or 7 years?
6 years, basically.
Yeah. By the time he's come back, what has he formed in terms of his intentions?
He's become a famous young man because he's brought back all these specimens, so he's
yeah.
made his reputation, not as a thinker, but as a naturalist.
As a collector.
As a collector.
Yeah.
And he gives the things to other people to sort through. But it's at this moment that one of the great adventures in human consciousness takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Because the young Darwin, who really has found himself now, he has some self-confidence, starts reading philosophical and economic literature, and he starts struggling with the problem of the origin of species and the nature of evolution. And he keeps a group of private notebooks where he scribbles down his ideas. And you see this man's mind growing by leaps and bounds, and his audacity, his courage. And he begins to look at all the classical texts, and he begins to see things that no one had seen before. And he writes at one point, "He who would explain baboon knows more about man than Locke, than the great philosopher."
But he is also sensitive, is he not, to the fact that he's transgressing.
Yes.
He's transgressing against essentially established religion.
Yes,
he knows religion that he once internalized.
That he did indeed internalize, he had been trained for, and then it makes it much more extreme as he's going to get married. He decides, he writes a wonderful, charming little memorandum to himself for and against marriage, decides to get married, proposes to his cousin, Emma, and then tells her...
She's a Wedgwood.
She's a Wedgwood. And then confides in her this great idea. I have this amazing idea about natural selection. And she's shocked.
So the idea has formed that early?
Yes, the idea is it's not fully formed, but it's essentially formed by the late 1830s. He sees the essential pattern, which is that if you imagine selection by extinction, as we were talking, you could see how there'd be slow improvement and slow change and directional change. And he tells it to Emma, and Emma writes him a long moving letter saying, "It's a terrible idea because if it's true, it means we can never live together in eternity." And he loves his wife. They have an extremely happy marriage and 10 children. And one of the reasons, you know, the question of Darwin's delay is one of the fascinating questions in the history of science and the history of thought. And there are many reasons for it. He's trying to get enough ammunition, because just as you said a moment ago, Milt, lots of people had evolutionary ideas. That was of no value. It was proof of evolution that was important. And some of it is because he's sensitive, he's a little scared. And finally, some of it is because he knows that publishing this idea will shock and dismay his Christian and religious wife. And he really doesn't want to do that. And I think that it's two things. One, practical, when finally Alfred Wallace comes up with the same idea, mm-hmm. another naturalist comes up with the same idea, that spurs him to publication. And his daughter, their daughter Annie, his favorite of all his children, dies when she's only 10. And that also makes him lose the last vestiges of faith and propels him forward towards publishing his great idea.
Of course, by so doing, he not only brings upon himself the onus of being a disbeliever or one who has abandoned true Christian conviction, but he has done something which, in rather short time, shakes up a whole culture.
Yes, it becomes, well, it's complicated. You know, it's interesting because when the book is published, it shakes up the whole culture, and yet there's a certain receptivity to it as well.
Yes.
Many people, more people than you would expect.
Because the doubt on the part of, particularly on the doubt of the upper middle class who had read a fair amount and were sophisticated, doubt about the fundamentals of Anglican or of biblical literalism generally was already spreading.
Exactly so. Yeah. So it was already present. So some surprising people agree with him. You know, he sends one of the first signed copies of the book to Queen Victoria's chaplain, Charles Kingsley. Mm-hmm. And Kingsley, a Christian man, writes a wonderful, bizarre children's book called Water Babies that involves Darwin and Darwinian ideas. And his attitude, surprisingly, an enlightened clergyman, is to say, you know what? Darwin is the Newton of biology. He's discovered, just as Newton discovered the beautiful principles that God had put in the world, Darwin's discovered the beautiful principles that God put into life. So it wasn't necessary to see it as an attack on organized religion, but there's no question that the literal biblical account of creation couldn't survive the evidence that Darwin had. And so, though Darwin was not himself a saboteur of faith, that was one of its inevitable consequences.
Come back to the parallel. You mentioned Plutarch before. The whole structure of Plutarch's lives is parallel lives.
Exactly.
Not necessarily people who live the same sort of life, but people who are appropriate for comparison to one another.
Exactly so.
In classical antiquity, and are in the history, really, of Rome and Greece before Rome. What's the Plutarchian model here?
Between Darwin and Lincoln?
These are not identical lives. They are both great innovators, or they are both people who push history or push modernism forward. We agreed to that before, and helped to shape it. But what else ties them apart, of course, from the accident of, or at least the fascinating fact of their being born on the same day of the same year?
You know, we could write parallel lives of a lot of remarkable men and women. We could write Darwin and Marx, for mm-hmm. instance. We could write Lincoln and Bismarck, with lots of possibilities. Here's what ties them together for me. They are both liberals. I don't mean liberals in the sense that they would vote Democratic.
Yeah.
I mean, they're liberals in the broad sense, that they believe in liberal civilization.
Define liberal in that context.
Liberal, in other words, believing in an open society with a democratic basis, based on fair play and open legal proceedings, and with a deep belief in the growth of knowledge, in science. The liberalism of John Stuart Mill, for instance, that kind of liberalism, believing in the liberty of the individual to think for himself, in liberty of society to choose its own way and to progress.
Lincoln writes in those terms, and of course he violates liberty with some severe measures during the war.
In narrow sense he does, but I think that Lincoln is rightly seen as one of the icons of liberalism, both because he liberates the slaves.
To be sure.
And because he believes in a liberal society.
But do we find in Darwin's life any direct address to issues and to problems in political life?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes.
He writes in those terms as well.
Darwin was a passionate abolitionist. That was one of the prime moving forces of his life. He had learned to hate slavery on his trip to South America. In fact, got in big fights with the captain about it. And one of the guiding, there's a new book about this in addition to my own, which is extremely good. One of the guiding lights of his whole theory is that human beings are all part of one family. That the notion that races are as different as species, first of all, he doesn't believe species are all absolutely different, but the idea that there was separate creations for black people and white people is anathema to him. And one of his guiding passions is to show that we have one common history as men. And when, it's a lovely story, when Colonel Higginson, do you remember Colonel Higginson? He was Thomas Wentworth Higginson. He was Emily Dickinson's great patron, and he was one of the officers who brought together a black regiment in the Civil War. And he went to visit Darwin after the Civil War in England, and Darwin hated receiving people. He was one of those Englishmen who just hated having his domestic circle intruded on, so I suspect he gave Higginson quite short shrift. Then he found out afterwards who Higginson was and what he had done. And he writes him a long, beautiful letter saying, had I known you were the man who organized the black regiment and showed the extraordinary capacities of Negroes to fight, to organize, showed their equality, I would never have treated you so dismissively when you were here, but I didn't realize it at the time.
Did the lives of Wilberforce and Darwin overlap at all?
They certainly overlap, but they don't touch. I mean, they're
around. Wilberforce is essentially 18th century. Of course, he was the leading proponent against slavery.
Yes. And to be fair, you could oppose slavery. And remember, the Darwin family, the Wedgwoods and the Darwins, had also been abolitionists. There's that beautiful plate, early Wedgwoods, mm-hmm. that says, am I not a man and a brother?
Yes.
And let me be completely accurate and fair here. You could oppose slavery from a strongly religious background. Most of the great, most of the great opponents of slavery in England and in America came at it from a religious background. So it wasn't as though that was the choice. But Darwin's passion for abolition was inextricably tied to his belief in a single history of human life.
One fascinating thing that I've encountered lately is that what we call intelligent design and the intelligent design movement mm-hmm. is not a recent invention. In fact, there were books written in Darwin's time and even preceding him, which argued that the mechanism of evolution was God's intervention
yes.
in designing ever higher species.
Yes, that's the argument from the perfect watch. In other words, that the proof of God's mm-hmm. existence was something as perfectly tuned and engineered as the human eye or the wing of a bird.
Indeed, that gives the basis for the title of one of Richard Dawkins' books, The Blind Watchmaker.
His best book, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes, and Darwin demolished that argument. And you know, a lovely thing is he wrote a précis of the argument against that argument, proving how, of course, it's always to an advantage even to have half an eye, to have a light-sensitive membrane. Mm. And he gave it to Emma to read. This is long before the publication. And she wrote on it, if I remember correctly, a great supposition, ED, meaning she wasn't convinced by uh-huh. Darwin's argument. And I've often thought that the special pleading explanatory tone that makes On the Origin of Species such a great and winning, seductive book is because at some unconscious level, Charles is arguing with his wife, trying to persuade his wife, who was writing that cutting of great supposition.
Did she remain doubtful all the way through their lives?
It's a beautiful story. She never wavered in her faith. She remained a Christian uh-huh. to the end. And she bowdlerized his autobiography, which he'd written for his kids a bit, after he had died, in order to remove the most obviously free-thinking and anti-religious parts of it. But he adored her, and that letter that she had written to him when they were young lovers, in which she had expressed her hesitations about his great idea, he took out again when he was very old and dying and covered mm-hmm. it, and as he said, he covered it with kisses and tears. It's a beautiful story of toleration, tolerance of the deepest kind. And Darwin once wrote a letter to Karl Marx's son-in-law, if you can imagine, when he was trying to get him to endorse an anti-religious tract, and he said, you know, I believe in the progress of science, and I believe that the progress of science will do all the necessary work that polemics cannot do. And anyway, he said, there are people in my family who would be offended and hurt by this, and I don't want to hurt and offend people in my family. Darwin's a very good man.
Doesn't he wind up buried in Westminster Abbey?
Yes, he does, and it's a kind of apotheosis of an agnostic.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting side in it. And, you know, one of the reasons is because Darwin was so, with all his sensitivity, was immensely shrewd. He put forward one of the most revolutionary ideas in human history, but he put it forward in a way that was so elegantly argued and so deliberately non-offensive, so deliberately winning and open-hearted that for all the damage it did to the pillars of the establishment, he was still accepted as a great figure.
I love to play the game of historical contingency.
Great game. Counterfactuals.
Counterfactuals. And one of the easiest ways is simply to end the lives of crucial figures early in their careers. Imagine, would have been very unlikely, but imagine Lincoln was shot down and killed in the Black Hawk War, fought here in Western Illinois. Or imagine that that something happened on the Beagle. Could he have died of scurvy or something like
could
that?
Have, could have died of dysentery, scurvy, or a million
there
other.
There you are. After some impending commercials, what are your speculations as to what the world would be like now if we hadn't had Lincoln, if we hadn't had Darwin?
I will tackle
that. Returning to Adam Gopnik directly after this. And directly back to Adam Gopnik. So that your choice, if you choose to accept it, is, or your assignment, if you choose to accept it, is to give us the world without Lincoln or the world without Darwin.
Will you self-destruct in 10 seconds if I don't? World without Lincoln. Had Lincoln been killed in the Black Hawk War or something, I think certainly the Civil War would have happened. The forces, the historical forces that were leading to it were inevitable. And you could argue that the North would inevitably have won. That's a familiar argument. You could almost argue that maybe under tougher, more abolition-minded leadership of someone like Seward, they would have sorted out the bad generals from the good generals even sooner. What we would not have, certainly, are the words. And the words are not just window dressing, Lincoln's words. They were able to define the meaning, not just of the war, but of what it means to be an American, of our liberal democracy, so beautifully. If it weren't for Lincoln, we wouldn't have someone be able to say, as he did in the second inaugural, but one of them, one of those two sides, would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish, and the war came. That simple, biblical, Shakespearean speech is vital. It's like the DNA of the American national identity. So those words that only Lincoln could have said, because there was no one remotely like him as a phrase maker or as a writer in his time, those words are essential to who we are. It's a bit like asking, could we have had the civil rights movement without Dr. King? Probably, inevitably, black people in America would be free, but Dr. King set music that we can all dance to, that's part of the music of our nation. Darwin, certainly, again, the theory of evolution by natural selection would have been arrived at. We know it was arrived at independently by Alfred Wallace. But it would not then have been Darwinism, because what makes Darwin so remarkable is that Darwin not only has the idea and illustrates it, but he makes it into a complete view of life. It isn't just a narrow scientific proposition, though it is that. It's an entire view of life, and he writes those beautiful lines, like those wonderful lines, Milt, that come at the end of The Origin of Species. Nothing is easier than to admit in words the truth of the universal struggle for life, or more difficult, at least I have found it so, than constantly to bear this conclusion in mind. We behold the face of nature bright with gladness. We do not see, or we forget, that the birds which are idly singing round us mostly live on insects and seeds, and are thus constantly destroying life. That vision, which is poetic in its own quiet English way, gives us a sense not just of evolution through natural selection, but of an attitude to take towards it, of a kind of possibility of seeing in our contemplation of the endless round of death and time, something that Darwin himself said has grandeur. There is grandeur in this view of life. And we depend on that Darwinian grandeur to make sense, in a sense, of our own mortality. Without Darwin, natural selection, without Darwin, no grandeur.
He does go on in that very passage at the end of The Origin to say of those birds, and we eat, and then we eat them.
Yes, that's right. And we are entangled in the entangled bank. Yeah. That vision of the entangled bank is Darwin's alone. So the thesis of this book really is that the words are not window dressing. The words are not ornament. Mm. The words are marrow. The words are bone. And it's the words that they give us and the language that they use that's their most fundamental gift to us.
Who else has similar significance and centrality in the shaping of modern sensibility?
Well, I think you certainly have to say that the other two figures that people look at are Freud and Marx. And 50 years ago, I think we would probably have been arguing about Freud. But they were both wrong. In plain English, they were both wrong.
Yeah.
Marx was wrong in his predictions of what would happen. Freud was wrong in his, though a wonderful writer and a wonderful essayist of a kind, Freud was wrong in his basic understanding of psychology, or at least has been empirically shown to be so. And yet Darwin and Lincoln live with all of the hesitations.
Because they were both right.
Yes, in plain English, they were both right. In plain English, they were both right. Of course, because they were human beings, they were often wrong. But in essence and at core, they were both right, and they continue thus to shape our lives.
Is there any figure of more recent vintage who has had or will turn out to have had the same sort of transformative significance?
What an interesting question. What a rich question. I can tell you who doesn't have it, and it helps you understand Lincoln's greatness more clearly. You know, Lincoln's role in the whole of the Western world was exactly as if Boris Yeltsin, after the fall of the Soviet Union, had been able to hold the Soviet Union together and make it, or hold Russia together, mm-hmm. and make it a real working democracy. Just think, Mel, of how differently the world would seem to us now, how much more faith and hope we would have in the liberal revolution if that had happened. And that's what Lincoln did at a crisis moment when it seemed as though democratic societies were going to just disappear from the earth. He held one together and kept it essentially democratic.
Well, the other great contingency or alternative history speculation is what would the world be like? What would our history have been like after the Civil War if John Wilkes Booth had missed?
Ah, that's one of the big questions. Just 2 nights ago at Harvard, actually, I was on a panel where we were arguing exactly that mm-hmm. and debating it. Two strong views are possible. One is that Lincoln, having accomplished his historical task, would have slipped backwards. Wonderful story. When John Kennedy, JFK, adored Nehru, the great leader and maker of Indian independence, and he wanted to meet him. And when he finally met him, when JFK was president, he was hugely disappointed. And he said to John Kenneth Galbraith, who was the ambassador to India, you know, that's what Lincoln would have been like had he survived, had he not been killed. He wouldn't have grown in stature. He would have shrunk in stature. The other view is that Lincoln, with his own moral authority, would have made Reconstruction possible and would have made Reconstruction acceptable in some way to the South, would have been tough at the right times and soft at the right times.
Would have done better, surely, than Andrew Johnson.
Certainly would have done better than Andrew Johnson. But, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a Lincoln lover, but I'm skeptical that he could have done anything very differently. Lincoln wanted reconciliation, and it was very hard to have reconciliation unless you gave the old power structure in the South some of its power back. Mm-hmm. And to have reconciliation and black enfranchisement, that was a very, very tall order, as we know. I hope it would have been otherwise, but I'm not sure that it would have been.
Well, we have the words of the second inaugural in which he's really offering reconciliation, offering forgiveness, and really trying to set in motion a renewal.
A process of renewal.
You have some of the words of it, I'm sure.
I do indeed, right here. And, you know, even more, in a sense, than the second inaugural and from that point of view, is the very last speech he made, which was not a beautiful speech in itself, but was hugely important. That's when he stood at the White House window and said, in effect, that the black soldiers who had fought for the Union should have the right to vote. And John Wilkes Booth was standing in the crowd and said, this means, use that horrible word, enfranchisement, I'm going to put him over. And it was at that moment that Booth made the irrevocable decision to kill Lincoln.
And it is at this moment, we'll come back to some of those texts, I think. It is at this moment, though, that we call a halt as we go to the newsroom for an update on what's been happening. And then we do indeed return to Adam Gopnik. A little bit later on, we go to your phone calls on 591-7200. But right now, to the newsroom and to Paula Cooper. And we return to Adam Gopnik. We've been searching for Lincoln's literary accomplishment. And you are going to read something. We've also got, let's do both, because he is indeed one of the great writers in the American tradition. Read what you've got there, then we're going to go to the Cooper Union speech.
Absolutely.
For a brief excerpt, of course.
Well, one of my favorite habits that Lincoln had is the ability to sum up a complicated argument in a flat and often comic set of monosyllables. And in 1858, he's debating with Stephen Douglas. And Douglas was a genuine racist, I mean, really kind of ugly. And mocking at one point, Lincoln was insisting the Declaration of Independence included blacks. And Douglas said, I do not regard the Negro as my equal and positively deny that he is any kin to me, whatever. And Lincoln concedes, he's a politician, he says, I'm not sure what equal means, and it's my judgment that probably the races will never live on in what we now call integration, on in a footing of perfect equality. And then Lincoln says, notwithstanding all this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, in the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns. He is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas, and the equal of every living man. That's such a wonderful piece of simple American rhetoric. And it's polite and civil, but it's radical in its implication. It says, say what you will, when it comes to the fundamental principle of our country, the black man has every bit as much right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Here he is addressing the same basic question, the question of the role of the black man in our lives, and the question of the legality and ultimate fate of the slave system, in the famous speech at Cooper Union. What year is that?
1859.
It's just a year after the right. Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Exactly.
And Harold Holzer, whom you know, we both know, yes. Who was a great Lincoln historian, argues that it was this speech that made him a national figure.
Yes.
Let us hear the beginning of it, at least, right. as read by Sam Waterson.
Mr. President and fellow citizens of New York, the facts with which I will deal this evening are mainly old and familiar, nor is there anything new in the general use I shall make of them. If there shall be any novelty, it will be in the mode of presenting the facts and the inferences and observations following that presentation. In his speech last autumn at Columbus, Ohio, as reported in the New York Times, Senator Douglas said, "Our fathers, when they framed the government under which we live, understood this question just as well and even better than we do now." I fully endorse this, and I adopt it as a text for this discourse. I so adopt it because it furnishes a precise and an agreed starting point for a discussion between Republicans and that wing of the Democracy headed by Senator Douglas. It simply leaves the inquiry, what was the understanding those fathers had of the question mentioned? What is the frame of government under which we live? The answer must be the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution consists of the original, framed in 1787, and under which the present government first went into operation, and 12 subsequently framed amendments, the first 10 of which were framed in 1789. Who were our fathers that framed the Constitution? I suppose the 39 who signed the original instrument may be fairly called our fathers, who framed that part of the present government. It is almost exactly true to say they framed it, and it is altogether true to say they fairly represented the opinion and sentiment of the whole nation at that time. Their names being familiar to nearly all and accessible to quite all need not now be repeated. I take these 39 for the present as being our fathers who framed the government under which we live. What is the question which, according to the text, those fathers understood just as well and even better than we do now? It is this. Does the proper division of local and federal authority, or anything in the Constitution, forbid our federal government to control as to slavery in our federal territories? Upon this, Senator Douglas holds the affirmative and the Republicans hold the negative. This affirmation and denial form an issue. And this issue, this question, is precisely what the text declares our fathers understood better than we. Let us now inquire whether the 39 or any of them ever acted upon this question. And if they did, how they acted upon it, how they expressed that better understanding.
What's fascinating, Mill, about listening to that? Now, that's not a great piece of rhetoric. It's not inspirational. It's not, yes, we can, right? But look at what Lincoln is doing in those.
It's a very tight logical structure.
Exactly so. It's a legalistic structure.
Yeah.
He's saying, all right, I'll accept the premise that they knew what they spoke to this question better. What did they actually say? He talks about Inference and observation. Inference and observation. That's at the heart of Lincoln's rhetoric, at the heart of Lincoln's view of the world. He says, let's find out how those 39 voted. And then he goes on to show that they all voted on national questions of slavery. Well, you might think this is a sort of insurance adjuster's demonstration of something. So 39 of them voted this way and some voted the other way. What does it matter? Well, the point he's making is that the framers of the Constitution clearly believed and acted on the belief that slavery was a national question, that the North had as much right to speak to it as the South. And once you establish that, like a lawyer with an argument, once you establish that premise, then all the necessary moral consequences flow from that premise, because then you say, my view on slavery isn't any less legitimate for the nation's welfare than the view of a slaveholder in the South. So do you see, it's an extraordinary way of building an argument. It doesn't begin by haranguing. It doesn't begin by exhorting. It doesn't begin by insisting on a universal moral principle. It begins by saying, what are the facts in this case? Let's use the power of observation and inference to slowly build an argument, which will in the end lead to the conclusion that the country cannot survive half slave and half free, and that we must rearm ourselves morally to do what is right. It's an astonishing and, I think, essentially a new way of thinking about how to make a speech.
Isn't it interesting to note, if you look for further parallels, these two men that you have combined in this book quite properly, since they were born on the virtually at the same moment, though they had incalculable influence, and without them the world would have been taken a different direction, that both still have their detractors, and those who in fact cynically denounce them as false prophets and as falsely worshipped. There are many in the South, including some intellectuals. There's a guy named DiLorenzo,
sure,
who's done a good deal of writing, sure, to falsify Lincoln, mm-hmm, and to see him as a mean and low and dishonest politician. Then, of course, with regard to Darwin, there is a whole movement which insists that not only was he utterly wrong, that he was somehow evilly wrong, intending to somehow knock our whole religious tradition off the track and beginning a kind of, and opening up a phase in our history which becomes valueless,
yes,
in which nothing, there's no firm value.
Leads directly to Hitler.
There are those who argue social Darwinism, as propounded by one of his followers, Herbert Spencer, does lead virtually directly to Hitler. We need to talk about the detractors, about the cynics, about those who still see both as injurious rather than as advancing the human cause and the human condition. We'll perhaps pursue that for a moment after we pause for this. Well, I guess a prophet is without honor, not only in his own country, but sometimes everywhere else. They tend to rouse opposition, which may persist on for the centuries.
A prophet is usually without profit in his own country, too. It's a good way to start.
What do you make of the anti-Lincoln movement? Which has it risen and gained more strength or ferocity in recent years?
Here's how. There's always been an anti-Lincoln movement in the South that's sort of has a diehard quality about it. And there the case is that Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, which indeed he did, that he was never really devoted to freeing the slaves, that he was, as we were talking about before, just this Bismarckian nationalist who could not stand the idea of local self-expression.
And that he violated the Constitution. The South had every right to secede.
Yes, exactly. That's the key issue in that point of view. And that's been joined in recent years by African-American thinkers on some cases who feel that Lincoln is a phony because he never really cared.
Henry Louis Gates up at Harvard does that.
Right. Well, Gates, to be fair, believes that Lincoln was never devoted, was never the simple figure who was Father Abraham. But what Gates believes, and I think it's true, there's a wonderful new book by a guy named John Stalfour called Giants about Lincoln's relation with Frederick Douglass. And what I think is true about Lincoln from that point of view is that you have to remember, in the 1850s, slavery was the issue, and racism was simply the long shadow that it cast. And Lincoln was imperfectly anti-racist, but he was always radically anti-slavery. And in that fight, he did not give ground. So in that way, it seems to me that, Lincoln grew a great deal in office until at the end, after the second inaugural, he had Frederick Douglass, the greatest of all African-American leaders of his time, maybe of all time, to the White House and said in public, here is my friend, here is my friend.
And that was the first black man ever to come as a guest to the White House.
That's right, and it wasn't through the back door. He came in through the front door. So that's, I think that that's the case about Lincoln. The broader case about states' rights and secession, all that too, I frankly think is a bit of a phony, because no matter how you try and fudge it, what was at issue in the war was slavery and the continuation of slavery. The South did not secede in 1861 for reasons that were incidental to the election of Abraham Lincoln. South seceded because Abraham Lincoln, a man who stood for the Republican Party, which was not a completely abolitionist party, but largely so, had become president. But let's talk about the Darwin haters a bit, the Darwin critics a bit, because the truth is the Lincoln haters are a bit of a fringe cause. Mm-hmm. Darwin, the criticism of Darwin is much more central. It goes on with much more violence and vehemence, let's say, of feeling than not. A couple of things I think that need to be said about it. One is that Darwin himself was, though he was became at the end of his life an agnostic, did not see his theory, did not see his idea as marking the end of spiritual belief. He loved his wife, and his wife was a devout Christian. Nor was that the way it was largely read, or certainly not the way it was exclusively read in his own time. It is true, and I will say in blunt, plain English, it is true that the fundamentalist account of the creation and history of Earth, read literally in the Bible, does not survive the truth of Darwinism. It just doesn't. And if you want to recuperate it, you have to ignore the facts and the truth.
And this relates not only to biology, it relates to geology, so to speak.
Exactly.
And the Bishop Usher schedule for the total history of mankind, I guess creation begins 6,000 or 7,000 years ago.
And it does. And we can't scant it. On the other hand, so far as I know, there are very few people of profound religious feeling in modern times, theologians or poets like W.H. Auden, my great hero, who my son is named after, who was passionate, devout Christian and wrote wonderful Christian poetry, wonderful poetry of belief. Auden, nor any of the great theologians, believed that the biblical account of creation was a necessary part of their faith. Their faith had an entirely different basis, and it spoke to questions of good and evil and meaning, which were independent of how mankind happened to be on Earth.
Well, when you call fundamentalism fundamentalist, it's fundamental about taking the words of the Bible, and in this case the words of Genesis, as what's the term they use? It's irrefutable.
Not irrefutable, but they call it perfect.
It's ear something.
Yes, it's ear something. It's ear something. So in any way, Mel, it seems to me that to be blunt, the truth of Darwinism, the truth of the Darwinian theory, which is still a theory, still growing, still evolving, still changing all the time, nonetheless, its essential truth is beyond dispute.
Well, one of the most foolish attacks against Darwin is this little dance. But it's only a theory. Sure, it's a theory, mm-hmm. and it's only a theory, therefore you can't announce that it's true.
Right. And it's true, but it's a theory that has sustained test after test after test,
well,
and has grown and gone on. Here's the crucial thing.
All theories are open to
right.
It's an ultimate false
reputation,
falsification.
Exactly
yeah.
So. Here's the thing that I think is at the heart of it, is that what people mean, and I try and write about this in the book, when they're upset by the ideas of Darwin, and not that they're committed to 7 days of creation or any of that. What it means is that they feel that Darwinism destroys, dynamites humanism. That is, our faith, our fundamental faith, that each individual human life has value, that what we're doing here on Earth has meaning, that we're not just like bugs and bees, and then we're just dancing our way towards...
And they feel also that it denies God moving in our lives.
Yes, and that's so. And what I say in the book, and I think it's true, is that humanism can have two meanings. You can mean man is the measure of all things, which is very man-centered, or you can mean, and this is what Darwin means, that all things can be measured by man. That is, that our ability to see, observe, and understand has in it something of, let's call it, the divine. Has in it something that is in itself inexpressibly powerful and valuable. And if you believe that, then you can see Darwinism, this great adventure in understanding, as central to what it really means to be a dignified human being.
Of course, there's been some argument in the world of science about some of the basic items in Darwinian evolution, surely with regard to the nature of the mechanism of change. For example, Gould at Harvard for many years was pushing his notion of, what did he call it?
Punctuated equilibrium.
Punctuated equilibrium, which meant there were sort of great leaps forward in certain periods of total organic history when there would have been a lot of variation, and then things sort of quiet down, and then once again they erupt. Drew a lot of evidence from something called the Burgess Shale,
yes,
he found up there in Canada, which is known as a major geological formation.
It happens to be Canadian. Yes, There are wonderful, and he wrote a terrific book, Wonderful Life, about it. Look, there are terrific, the sign of life, the sign that we're on the track to truth is argument. It's not agreement. Mm. Because when we have arguments, it's because we have significant evidence that we're struggling to fit into a theory. You know when two people are arguing that they are moving towards the truth, and you know when they're in enforced agreement that they are moving away from the truth. So the reality of argument within evolutionary theory is a sign of its richness. That's what makes it interesting. On the whole, though, even the most vivid arguments, the most violent arguments between people like Gould and his detractors, someone like Dawkins, for instance, are basically, they agree about 98% of what happened, and they're arguing about the 2%. Now, that's an important 2%. They're not arguing about that the eye could not have evolved. Everyone accepts that. They're not arguing about the length of time that it's taken, and they're not arguing about whether or not man has descended from some earlier kind of ape, in plain English. Everybody agrees about those things. Everybody who's taken the trouble to study it.
One thing that's intensified the opposition to evolutionary theory in recent time is that some evolutionary theorists have made a point of writing atheistic tracts. Dawkins particularly is one of those, and I think that has stirred the opposing camp.
Well, you know, Darwin, as I said before, was against that kind of...
He was indeed.
He was against that. He believed that the progress of science was inexorable and that people's minds would be illuminated by the sheer force of arguments and the sheer progress of science. Now, can I confess to mixed feelings about it? There's many things. I just read Dawkins' book. Let me read what Darwin has to say about the whole question of arguing. This is a letter he writes. I am a strong advocate for free thought on all subjects. Yet it appears to me, Darwin writes, whether rightly or wrongly, that direct arguments against religion and theism produce hardly any effect on the public. And freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds, which follows from the advance of science. It has therefore been always my object to avoid writing on religion, and I have confined myself to science. And then he adds, I may, however, have been unduly biased by the pain which it would give some members of my family, he means his wife, if I aided in any way direct attacks on religion. But I think Darwin's spirit there in having confidence that freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds, which follows from the advance of science. I think that's a strong, and it's a deeply, if I may say, deeply liberal attitude, because it implies an almost limitless tolerance for other people.
It is, of course, worth noting as well that religion, some major sectors of the Christian tradition, have come towards evolution. I have in mind particularly the Catholic Church.
Yes.
From John Paul II, we had a statement that all of this can be seen as having been initiated. The process is there. The mechanism is real. Evolution forms have evolved from other forms. Geological history runs across billions of years. But we have to acknowledge that somehow, this is where they stake out a new claim, that somehow soul entered into it, at least with Homo sapiens,
only with Homo sapiens, probably.
And God put soul in, and that he sort of started the whole process.
Look, it's not a view I share, and to be it's not a view that it's even easy to understand, because the line
It is now all virtually official Catholic dogma.
But it's a completely reasonable way to approach it. It seems a little hard for me to understand how it is that this particular homonym is distinct from all the others, but fine. I think that the point that should be made again and again is, if we're genuine liberals in the sense that I think Darwin and Lincoln were, the key concept we have is of toleration and of tolerance. It's not of insistence and polemic. And so the truth is that we live in a world, I say this in the last chapter, Milt, and some people who are friends of mine who are strong Darwinians objected to my saying this. I say it anyway. The truth is that the struggle can be overdrawn. We live in a world in which it's perfectly possible to have great religious poetry and great advances in evolutionary biology. Those two things are not inevitably at war.
A further interesting angle there is that you can find, there are now some evolutionary theorists who conjure the question of why is religion a universal in all societies, if not in all individuals? And they argue it has
adaptive,
adaptive value.
You know, I don't like those kinds of arguments, to be honest, Milt, because I think it condescends to religion. I don't want to condescend to religion.
Uh-huh.
It's like saying, why do we feel love? Why do we write poetry? Oh, it has adaptive value. It doesn't really, it explains away the phenomenon without explaining it.
It's known as evolutionary psychology.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a big fan of evolutionary psychology in that way. Not that they care whether I'm a fan of it or not. But I think that we can respect the integrity of religious feeling without condescending to it.
With that, we're going to pause in just a moment for an update on the news, and it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines, 591-7200. Of course, the number 312 is the area code, then 591-7200. Do get your calls in for any question or comment. Any evolutionary theorists, any religionists, anyone simply interested in these two fascinating and utterly important lives that we have been tracking, that Adam Gopnik does track in his new book, do by all means give us a call for a comment or a question. 312-591-7200. Or if you would rather reach us via email, that's always available as well. Particularly useful for those listening to us over the internet at some great distance, including those on other continents. And so, for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, .com. We look forward to your contributions. Get them in quickly. We shall return directly after this. And at last we go to the phones. 591-7200 is the number, 312 the area code, and to Max in Aurora. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Professor. I love your show. I've been listening to it for a long time.
There's no accounting for taste.
Yeah, I don't know. My taste in books actually might come into question on this one. I was somebody who had pictures that I had found in antique shops of President Lincoln and had them up on my wall. And recently I did come across the DiLorenzo books. And for me, they really changed my mind a lot because I think they are pretty factually based, and I don't know how much of a fringe movement that is. I don't know if it's obviously not big, so you'd call it a fringe movement, but I think the facts are there, at least for the arguments that Professor DiLorenzo.
Well, which facts particularly impress you?
Well, first off, there was President Lincoln's support of this fugitive slave law during his campaign in 1860, and then there was also the incident with the congressman from Ohio, Vallandigham, and of course the all the cases with journalists in the North that had completely shut down. And I mean, if I don't know if either of you have read the DiLorenzo books, and you know, some of your listeners have, but I don't want to go through the whole.
Well, I'm sure that Adam has. I've looked at some of his writing, but I haven't studied it closely. But what's your response to this?
Look, every one of our heroes and our saints should be subjected to the same rigorous appraisal as we would give to anyone else. Lincoln was not a perfect man. He was a human being, and he was a politician negotiating a very complicated strait and playing a difficult hand. There's a wonderful new essay by Henry Louis Gates Jr., Skip Gates. It's a preface. He has a whole book of Lincoln's writings on race, and he has a long introduction, which is extremely skeptical and critical in places about Lincoln's views on race, but ends with the idea, which I think is right, that two things are true. One is that Lincoln grew constantly, that his ideas about the future of African Americans changed. At one point, he favored recolonization, the kind of Liberian solution.
Then
he gave that up under the influence of events and under the influence of people like Frederick Douglass, that by the end of his presidency, he is speaking up, as I said before, a few days before his death, not only for abolition, but for the enfranchisement, the right to vote of all of the blacks who had fought in the Union Army, at least, and this, as I say, brings about his assassination by John Wilkes Booth. And it seems to me, as I said before, that we can pick and choose, and then of course there are other questions about the suppression of journalism, and there are questions about
and suspension of habeas corpus,
and the suspension
and the point that Professor Rosenberg had brought up earlier about the South's right to secede,
and how
the war, and what happened after the war, completely changed the constitutional order.
Right. I am one of those who believes, and all of these things are open for debate, and as I say, Professor Gates debates them very well in that essay, which I recommend highly.
Which is on Lincoln's views on race.
Right, exactly. Is that it seems to me, I'm one of those who feel, in my own reading of it, that there's no way to separate the question of slavery from the question of secession in 1861, that what's at stake in the war always, and though Lincoln says I would not necessarily free the slaves, but what's at heart of the war is the realization that the majority of Americans have voted for a party who opposed slavery, and that if to stay in the Union is to accept necessarily the long-term extinction of slavery.
Sure.
And it seems to me that since that's the crucial step, I think Lincoln looks pretty good.
Sarah, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much, sir.
Interesting contribution. And directly to another, here is Chris in Oak Lawn. Good evening.
Hello, Milton. And guest, I apologize, I forget the guest name, but...
Adam.
You must learn the guest name. It's Adam Gopnik, G-O-P-N-I-K.
Unfortunately so, but they brought the name from the old country.
And the title of the book is, you know, we haven't even talked about the generation of the title, and we will in a moment. The title of the book is Angels and Ages, and it's published by
Knopf.
Alfred A. Knopf and Company, and it's wonderful reading. Now go ahead.
Okay. Milton, I guess two things. Milton, one is to thank you for mentioning Pope John Paul II's earlier comment about the Catholic faith allowing for maybe
acceptance of evolution.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so many times I get frustrated when the Christian point of view of evolution is kind of just termed as as a fundamentalist part of the Bible. So Milt, thank you for mentioning that. I guess for Mr. Gopnik, I think earlier in the show we're talking about all the different parts of evolution, and I think Milton, or somebody made the comment of, it may not, evolution may not contradict the Christian faith, and that, that just shows there's, artificial, or not artificial, an intelligent designer, the perfect watchmaker. Mm-hmm. I think Mr. Gopnik made a comment that that Darwin had demolished that argument. I guess to clarify, what was Darwin's response to the idea of, I guess using today's terms, of
intelligent design.
First of all, let me say I don't set myself up as a Darwinian expert. I love to read Darwin, and my book is largely about Darwin the man and Darwin the writer. Mm-hmm. Let me recommend to you right away for a brilliant discussion of these problems, a book by a great evolutionary biologist who lives here in Chicago, Jerry Coyne.
Jerry was on this program just about 2 weeks ago.
Was he really? Well,
Jerry, about his new book.
Jerry Coyne's new book, Why Evolution is True, is the best introduction to evolution that I know. And Jerry really knows what he's talking about, and I only know what Jerry says about what he's talking about. But in brief, the idea is, to answer your question seriously, is that what Darwin showed is that things that seem extremely complicated, like the human eye, for instance, and that you don't think could be made through the process of natural selection, can be shown to be made through the process of natural selection, because we see lots of more primitive and simpler eyes throughout nature. And also because if you simply reason your way through it, you can see that even a piece of an eye, even just a light-sensitive membrane, would be hugely advantageous for any creature. So there are very few things, and this is what Darwin showed, that exist in nature that you can understand through a process of gradual adaptation. Now, not every problem is solved, but we can't find an example of that kind of mechanism that doesn't exist. But I urge Jerry Coyne's Why Evolution is True on you.
Hear, hear. And we pause for a last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones and to the email. 591-7200, area code 312, and for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And directly back to Adam Gopnik. I stumbled upon the fact, which we both noted a few minutes ago, that I haven't yet asked you about the title of the book, Angels and Ages. It has a specific historical reference.
Yes, it does indeed. When Abraham Lincoln died on April 15th, 1865, Edwin Stanton, his great Secretary of War, who had been an opponent early on, came to be a great admirer of Lincoln's, is said to have uttered as the last words, as Lincoln drew his last breath, "Now he belongs to the ages." It's a famous piece of American rhetoric, a famous probably maybe the most famous American epitaph. But there's an alternate school that insists that what Stanton actually said is, "Now he belongs to the angels." And you can imagine that historians who tend to break a little bit to the left, like "now he belongs to the ages," and historians who tend to break a little to the right, like "now he belongs to the angels."
And that also resonates to Lincoln's great line about the
better angels of our nature. What would angels mean to a Lincoln man? What did ages mean to a Lincoln man? So for me, though it's a small historical dispute, it was for me one with enormous symbolic resonance, because it speaks to exactly the questions that we've been talking about, that this book talks about. That is, should we see our lives horizontally, so to speak, on a horizontal frame, where what really matters is what we leave our children and what we give to history? Or should we see our lives on a vertical axis, where what really matters is how well we correspond to the will of God, what judgment is given of us in heaven? That's a fundamental modern dilemma, and it's one that's exemplified for me by that little dispute.
By the way, do you have any hypothesis as to which of those two utterances was
well? Do you know what? I
actually
came around to the view, to two views. One is, I think it was probably angels. That was sort of the
you
more
do.
Obvious
yeah.
sentimental thing, even though I prefer ages. The other thing is, if you ever go to the room where Lincoln died in the boarding house across the street from Ford's Theater, you will be shocked, because the room is tiny. It's unimaginably small. Sort of, to be a little blasphemous, like the stateroom scene in A Night at the Opera. There were 40 or so people yeah. crowded into that room. And I suspect, we all know they were all weeping and sobbing, and I suspect most of them couldn't even tell you what Stanton said. I'm sure they mostly came out of there saying, did he say angels? Did he say ages? What did he say? What did
who,
he say?
Who gives us the first report on that?
There's a corporal, a guy named Tanner, who's the who knows shorthand. And Stanton is giving a lot of orders that night, and he mm-hmm. goes out in the street and says, anybody know shorthand? And Tanner comes into the room, and Tanner says, it's angels. And mm-hmm. Tanner says, he said, now it belongs to the angels. But Nicolay and Hay, Lincoln's secretaries, when they write the standard biography of Lincoln, say that it's ages, and Hay was certainly there.
It's probably best and appropriate to leave it ambiguous, or to leave it unresolved.
Yes, well, that is exactly
because
sort of...
both statements are appropriate.
Exactly so. That's the moral of the story. That's the final lesson of the book.
And with that, back to the phones, 591-7200 and to Ted in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good evening.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Our pleasure, sir.
I normally tune into the station to hear a Blackhawks game, but I heard your guest there, and I have to take issue with his statement that Darwinian evolution, or I would presume he's talking about macroevolution, is accepted by all those who've taken the time to study the issue, and it's just simply not true. The biomechanical mechanisms of that have been greatly challenged, and I think very successfully, by people like Michael Behe in his book Darwin's Black Box. I think a lot of the other aspects of it have been challenged greatly. David Berlinski's book Devil's Delusion, I think, is fantastic in exposing a lot of the weaknesses of the Darwinian.
These
evolution.
Are the proponents of the so-called intelligent design approach.
Well, to be fair, may I?
Behe certainly is.
To be fair, they're not entirely intelligent designers. But finish your question, sir.
My basic assertion here is that the age of the Earth really is kind of a separate issue from whether Darwinian macroevolution could have taken place.
Let me try.
You could have 10 gazillion right. years, and Darwinian evolution still has many problems that I just don't think can be ever worked right. out.
Let me address it, if I may. It is certainly true that science benefits from having unorthodox views spread, and we should never try to suppress or discard and always pay great attention to unorthodox views. The views you're describing are, as a matter of fact, extremely unorthodox within the general understanding of evolutionary biology. It would take some time to go over piece by piece them. Again, I recommend Jerry Coyne's book, Why Evolution is True, which addresses these questions. And I would say simply that it is the case that no professional biologist, no one who studies evolutionary biology, I think, closely, agrees with those views. That doesn't mean they're wrong, but it does mean, I think, that the overwhelming, very nearly the unanimity of evolutionary biologists is in favor of Darwin's view of macroevolution and finds those views unpersuasive.
I don't have it in front of me, but I could just show you quotes from many, many people who, in all the fields of science, who have great questions.
With all respect, sir, I just think that that's not true. The fact is that evolutionary biology is as well established as any theory in the history of science, and the objections that you're citing, and as I say, they should be shown great respect because we always need new ideas and new objections, are ones that simply have never been substantiated by experiment, are ones that simply do not make sense of the history of life.
And that's about all we can do with it, I fear, sir, and I do thank you very much for the call. Though if I have to make a choice between the two positions, I think I have to vote for Adams' position rather than
the Calder. Well, I apologize because, you know, to explain what's wrong with what Behe and Berlinski is saying would take us another 3 hours. But again, I urge you to read Jerry Coyne's fine book, read Stephen Jay Gould's good books. These are all people who have wide differences themselves, but there is unanimity about the essential rightness of...
We've done debates on that sort of thing. That lawyer advocate of intelligent design.
Right.
I forget his name. Is it Johnson?
But let's remember, when intelligent design was put on trial in the Dover case,
yes, indeed,
there was not a single, and Behe was one of the people who testified, mm-hmm. he could not point to a single refereed serious scientific paper or argument in favor of that position.
I need to say a word to a listener who has just sent me what looks like a very interesting email, but it's just too long for me to be able to read it since it has just arrived. But to Mark, who signs himself as Mark A., and gives his name, a newly baptized WGN internet listener out east in northwest suburban Rochester. Thank you for the communication. If you got it in earlier, I would have been able to read it. But I will probably read it closely and maybe give you a response by email shortly. 591-7200 is the number as we go to Steve in Tinley Park. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt, Adam. I only turned on your program just before the top of the hour, but it touched something that I've wanted to discuss for a little while, and it seems like both sides of the issue, they seem to be mutually
deaf
against each other. And I've often wondered why nobody ever argues for the possibility of a gray area in there, that both could possibly exist. And part of what I'm talking about there is that I am Catholic myself. I went to a Catholic school, but, you know, you try to have an open mind. And not being well-read on Darwin or anything, but understanding the basics of it and that. Why is it, number one, the church teaches us that the universe was created in 7 days, you know, let there be light and all that, which is church doctrine, and you go with that. But why does nobody ever discuss what the 7 days were? They don't have to be seven of our 24-hour days. They could be seven periods in time, which would include Darwinism and evolution.
Well, Catholic theologians of the modern variety have made that very point.
Made that point over and over again. You know, the deeper point for me is, and this is Stephen Jay Gould made a suggestion like this, is that we're talking about different areas of inquiry here. If we're interested in the history of life, our understanding has to be based on Darwinism and on evolutionary biology. If we're interested in the meaning of life, the field is much wider, and we turn to faith, we turn to poetry, we turn to music, and anybody who tries to argue those things out of existence is making a mistake as well.
We are approaching the end of the available time, just about 2 minutes left. What an interesting life you've had, and what a fine career.
Well,
listeners who don't know all of your work don't know that, just don't know the other fine books that you've done.
Well, thank you, Milt.
Including that wonderful one about your life in Paris.
Well, Paris, the moon. You know, the great joy of being an essayist, and I am not a scientist, and I am not a scholar, so to speak, but the great joy of being an essayist is that you can follow your enthusiasms and you can share your passions. And I've had the joyful experience of being able to take a passion like living in Paris or a passion like reading Darwin and Lincoln as writers and write about them. And it makes for a lively existence.
Who are the great essayists who provide sort of a model for your own career or for your own approach?
My goodness, they vary, but they include Max Beerbohm, the great 19th century English essayist. Certainly Hazlitt, another great 19th century English essayist. And closer to home and more recently, Randall Jarrell, the great poet and critic of poetry.
Yeah.
It's a model of writing. And I always come back to W.H. Auden as a prose writer and as a poet.
Mm-hmm. Joe Epstein, a friend of mine here in town.
Right.
Is a very active essayist, as you
and probably and a very fine one, too.
And a very fine one, I think. And we did a program years ago about the art of the personal essay with a few people, Joe.
There are very few people left who practice it. Mr. Epstein is one. I hope I'm another. And Fadiman is still another. It's a fragile form, but I think it has the advantage of being able to combine emotion and intellect, ideas and feelings, in one package.
And I guess the New Yorker, for whom you do much of your writing, is a major base for that sort of that sort of constitution.
Maybe the only base anymore.
The only
times.
One left, do
but,
you think?
The only man left standing. I think there. I just got to edit a collection of best American essays, and the cheering thing, Milt, was that from all over the range, from tiny magazines to big commercial magazines, you can find good essays.
And with that, we do indeed come to the end of the available time. Once again, the title of the book by Adam Gopnik is Angels and Ages, and it is published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. We'll be back tomorrow night after a basketball game, I believe it is, we should get the air at around 10. And indeed, we're extending our celebration of Lincoln's 200th birthday to two nights. Tomorrow night, another major biographer of Lincoln, Ronald White. Until tomorrow at 10 or thereabouts, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.